Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Nicholas Terpstra about his book titled Senses of Space in the Early Modern World, published by Cambridge University Press as one of their elements. This is a really interesting book because it takes us back not just in time, but in space, in taste, in touch, and smell, to help us understand and explore how early modern people experienced things like sense and space. So this might be a very small physical book, but there's whole worlds within it. So Nick, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about it.
Thanks for inviting me, Miranda. It's lovely to be here.
We are very pleased to have you. Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Okay, sure. I am a professor of history at the University of Toronto in Canada, and my area of specialization is social history of the early modern period. So we roughly think of, say, the 1400s to about the 1700s, 1800s. And really, up until now, I've worked primarily on subjects at the intersections of politics, religion, charity, and gender, looking at things having to do with orphans, with abandoned children, with widows, with criminals. And I started about 10 years ago also then becoming interested in space and issues around space. I'd always been interested in maps. I'd always been interested in walking through the cities that I was looking at, and I should have clarified that I worked primarily in Italy, in a couple of Italian cities, starting off in Bologna and now working more in Florence and a few other cities I'll mention later. And what always interested me was how spaces converge, how people walk through spaces, how spaces appear to us when we're walking through them on foot. And that started to work its way into my research and writing about 10, 15 years ago. And I also then started working with a colleague, Colin Rose of Brock University, also in Canada, on preparing a digital map of some of the cities that we have in Italy in particular. So we started with Florence, took a 1561 census of Florence and combined it, took that data into a database, and then georeferenced it to a 1584 map. And we were able to use that to show where people lived, what they did in different places, you know, where the bakers were, where the butchers were, how close from that the candlestick makers were. And we've now moved on to a couple of other cities. We're just finishing a recreation of a city on the coast called Livorno, which is really important for us, not just because it was a new city made in the early modern period, a kind of a new planned city, but also because it was almost totally destroyed in the Second World War. So we now have a digital recreation of that city, again, combined with the data from a 1648 tax census. So we're doing that kind of thing, trying to bring different forms of information together to get a better sense of how whole populations lived and how whole cities functioned together.
Hey. Very interesting projects and perspective. You know, I think a lot of us can relate to that idea of moving through cities and experiencing them. So I suppose why not go back and see what sorts of questions we might ask about the same sort of idea, but in a different time. Can you tell us a bit more about the specific questions you're asking in this book and how you developed them, given this broad interest?
Sure. The part that came to me, or the reason why it came to me in this way, is that the whole area of spatial history, sensory history, all of these are getting much more attention, have been getting much more attention than, say, the last 10, 15 years. And some of that goes back to earlier works from already the 80s and 90s by some French historians, Lucien Lefebvre and Michel de Certeau. People who looked at not simply space as, say, a two-dimensional reality that's charted on a map, but really a three-dimensional experience, and then asking how that experience shapes the way we might understand it and understand historical human beings going through spaces. So we've moved beyond simply maps to look at what it meant to taste in certain areas, look at what it meant to live, to walk, to to smell in certain areas. And this is really the kind of thing that we take for granted in the world today in the way that we walk through the world. But it wasn't something that historians had really done for the early modern period. And so I was joining with, I guess you could say, a whole range of people who started asking those questions and wondering how we can best get at that early modern sensorium. A number of people think quite legitimately that it's very difficult for us to really have access to early modern senses, that that we really can't assume that what the early modern people smelled was what we smell, or that how they smelled is how we smell, or taste, or sound, or emotion. And I understand that, and I could accept that to some extent intellectually. And yet, I also thought it's really placing such a high level, such a high bar for understanding, that really almost nothing becomes understandable in the past. Because I think that the same thing you could say that you say about senses or emotions, you could say about anything, intellectual life. If I read Shakespeare now, how do I know that I'm reading it the way somebody in the 17th century would have read it? If I read Montaigne, if I read the Bible. So I felt that maybe one way to get at the sensorium was not to try to isolate senses, but to see them in combination. And so that was why I came up in this book with trying to see things in combination with each other or in convergence. And so it's a few chapters looking first at the sight of space, and then looking at the force of sound, looking at the sights of smell, looking at the taste of time, and then the times of touch. So I'm not trying to be exhaustive. I'm not trying to offer a summary or even a field survey. There's an enormous amount of literature that's come out recently. But I'm really, I guess you could say, trying to give a taste of, you know, how we might approach this as an experiment, as a thought experiment, and as an experiential experiment.
Very interesting. Thank you for taking us through that. To go in then to the kind of realm of the experiment, can you explain to us what time period the book covers and how you chose these start and end dates?
So the time period is really, say, the 15th century, and I can't say there's a particular date within that time period, but the 15th century to about the end of the 18th century. And the reason why I chose those dates, or that period, let's say, the early modern period, was because that's when globalization really starts to transform the way Europeans live and act in the world, the way they experience the world, the kinds of experiences that come to them. It's when a whole range of foods that they had never tasted before suddenly become available to them. It's, of course, when whole continents they hadn't imagined suddenly come into view. It's a time when they start building cities in different places. It's a time when they move gradually from really a sense of awe in the world towards a sense of occupation and ownership and domination. And so I'm also trying to look at how Europeans' own experience of the world gradually begins to shift from a time when, in the 15th century and the 16th century, despite their rhetoric, which could often be very boasting and extravagant, they realized that they were the inferiors to the Ming Dynasty in China, the Ottomans in modern-day Turkey, even the Aztecs in Central America. They realized their own inferiority in spite of the rhetoric about their superiority. But by the end of that period, they've moved to another realm, not just in their rhetoric, but in their sense of their ownership of the world. So I was trying to look at how senses also, to some extent, I don't want to say mediate that transition, but how senses shift over that period of transition, and how you, I guess you could say, the European sense of the world starts to shift as their senses of it also shift.
Hmm. I think based off that answer, listeners will not be surprised that you are looking at places that are not just within continental Europe. Can you tell us a bit more about the four cities that you focus on? Why those four? And I guess also why four? Was there a fifth that almost made the cut but didn't?
Certainly. Part of this is extraordinarily practical. The series for which this book was commissioned and then written has a very tight length limit, 30,000 words. And so I realized that if I was going to try to cover everything, I'd go mad, and I wouldn't be able to do it. So the picking four cities was part of the way, or part of the strategy for making it manageable, because I thought then we can pick up experiences that people will already be a bit familiar with and carry these through and then show them in four different places. There were four cities that are the focus, but of course, things go beyond that. The four are Florence in Italy, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, Boston in colonial New England, and then Manila in what becomes the Philippines. And the reason for those four was because I wanted to take four that were slightly... That would not be expected. One could readily expect that that four cities that you would take would include, say, Rome, Paris, New York, and, I don't know, Istanbul, for instance. Large capital cities. What I wanted to do was take cities that were, in a sense, slightly out of the spotlight, although I guess you could say of these four, both Florence and Amsterdam are really very much in different kind of spotlights. But I wanted to use them to show different kinds of ways that people experience the world, and also different kinds of political settings. So what we've got here in Europe is one old city, Florence, an old city which is very much related as well to Catholicism, and then Amsterdam, a much newer city in its early modern expansion and very much a center of Protestantism. Then I wanted to find two cities outside that were, in a sense, the cities that were established through colonial expansion. And then, again, I wanted to extend that difference of regime and religion. So Boston as an English colony, and then predominantly Protestant, and Manila as a Spanish colony and predominantly Catholic. With each one of these, there are also cities where you have certainly an enormous influx of different kinds of people. So these are all cities that are experiencing a lot of change in the early modern period. They are to some extent, each of them, new capitals, new cities that have a lot of new development, cities that are associated with a lot of cultural exchange, and cities then that allow us to see what is new in the early modern period and how are those experiences shifting, changing.
Okay, there are so many things I could ask you just about that answer about cities. there's so many things to pull from there. But before kind of I start doing that, I want to talk a little bit more about sources now that we've got a sense of time period and places. You mentioned earlier the kind of big picture debate about the extent to which we can know anything about the early modern sensorium and your conclusions about, that this is an experiment we can undertake. In pursuing that experiment, then, what sorts of sources can we use? How can we access this?
Well, I think we access through the kinds of things that social historians in particular look a lot at. So, letters, memoirs, travel documents. There's an awful lot of travel literature that comes on. Imaginary literature, so novels, stories, songs, poems. There's a whole range of documents from that time period. The thing that often is the reality that social historians have to work at is that many of these documents were written without the writers having the questions in mind that we are now asking. So you're always approaching them tangentially. You're always approaching them to some extent against the grain. You can never really take at face value what people are saying about themselves or about others. So you're always reading. You're reading to some extent to mine what's there, but that almost makes it seem as though you're simply looting it for information. As much as anything, you're trying to get into the mentality of the people of the past, and if you can inhabit that world, then you can also get a sense of what kinds of things they're thinking of when they do taste something different. Now, what I'm doing in this book, and the again, really largely because of the limits of space, the references that I can make are references to other recent literature. So in this particular book, I was not able to go very deeply into sources. I didn't go into actual sources, say in Manila or in Boston, but I relied on the work of others. What I did try to do in a number of instances was use visual sources, and then also in some cases, and Boston stands out for here, worked to some extent with archaeological evidence. And some of that is more finely developed in some cities than in others. Boston, because they had built in the last few decades, they built this enormous underground freeway. The archaeological evidence for Boston suddenly exploded. And the kinds of things we can understand about how Bostonians lived is really phenomenal, largely because of that large infrastructure project that was done. They don't have anything similar at this point, anyway, for Manila. There are different kinds of things for Amsterdam. Amsterdam is one of the cities where I talk more about smell. And part of that was because of an excellent exhibition that Amsterdam museums, and particularly the Rijksmuseum, had put on a couple of years ago, where they explored precisely this. So a lot of it is, I guess you could say, surfing the waves of that work that's been done by other historians in other places over the past couple of decades, and then trying to share that with readers here, try to bring some of it together and share it and see where people would go with it.
No, that's very helpful to understand. So thank you for explaining that. To get into then some of the aspects of the sensorium that you were able to discover and portray in the book, can you talk to us about open and closed spaces? I found this particularly evocative, the dynamics of walking through a city and having spaces that are open, spaces that are closed, and moving between them. How did this sort of thing impact how people experienced and also even conceptualized both kind of what a city was in the early modern period and who belonged in them?
Right. I think one of the things we start with all of these cities is that all of them are walled to some extent. And so you start with the disjunction between your experience of those cities and the cities we live in now, where we don't really have physical walls. So we already start to think of the city in a different space, in a different way, let's say. And that sense of a walled space goes way back to medieval and early Roman times as well, that the wall differentiated or separated different experiences of life, different sets of rules, different sets of rights and privileges. And so the experience of space in an early modern city begins right at the gate, or I guess you could say outside the gate. And again, one thing that struck me in some of the earlier work I was doing was when you see maps and when you see geographies, great atlases, as they multiply in the 16th century. Europeans were fascinated with seeing pictures of other cities and what they looked like, and so you get these multi-volume collections of aerial views, maps of different cities. Never really been done before, but it expands in an extraordinary way here, and we have some examples of these that are hundreds of maps. And in many cases, what you've got is a rough representation of the houses and the spaces and the towers within the walls. And then outside the walls, it's often completely bare, or there's farm fields, or there's an open space. And we know that that simply wasn't what it was. We know that there were suburbs outside the walls. We know that there were whole classes of people who were forced there to live there. We know that there were cemeteries, there were gardens. And yet in these maps, these visual presentations, what that is to say, what people thought of when they thought of their city It was really the walls and the space within it. So that already set me thinking about, you know, how do we approach that conjunction? How do we approach that disjunction, I guess you can say, between the space inside the walls and outside the walls? And then how do you walk through? And so with this book and with other work I've done, I tried as much as possible, where it was possible, to walk the spaces that I'm talking about. And because a lot of my work has been done in Florence, that's a particularly accessible place to me. But I think you could do the same, certainly in Amsterdam, a little less so in Boston, and probably even less so in Manila, simply again because of later developments. But as we walk through, then we see how people would have experienced narrower streets and then suddenly broadening out to larger streets, how they would have seen the juxtaposition of particularly institutions like convents, public buildings like courts, churches and church towers, the intersection or alternation of market spaces and great plazas that you know, marked off where a ruler might be. That again, as you go through and as you just try to focus on what's built, you realize again that the way streets come together, it brings certain buildings into prominence, and it also, in other ways, shuts off other parts of the spaces to you. And that's where what I was trying to emphasize was that there are many parts of the early modern city that are behind walls, not just the city walls, but they are what we call enclosures. And the one that people may be most familiar with would be convents, that convents for nuns are enclosed. Nuns were not supposed to move out of the convents, and other people were not supposed to move into them. And we know that that's a wall with many cracks in it. Not as many cracks by the early modern period as there had been, say, in the medieval period. But what's also interesting is that the very thing which reinforced those walls for nuns, say, in the 16th century, in the Council of Trent, or the Catholic Council that really established a renewed regime of oversight and orthodoxy within Catholicism, and regime then that said, going back to an ancient late 13th century rule called Periculoso, which had said that convents should be totally enclosed, that had fallen to some extent out of practice, but it was being reinforced in the late 16th century. And the idea was that these walls had to be both protective, but also purifying. And that idea of coming together, bringing together protection and purification, somehow took root in early modern minds, and so they extended it to many other groups and many other parts of the city. So certainly convents had walls going up and walls being reinforced, but also poor houses, also orphanages, also to some extent hospitals, also in a number of cities, ghettos that would segregate the Jewish populations, so that what had to some extent been open spaces within the city walls were increasingly being closed off by these walls, which were meant to protect / purify whole groups within society. And then also walls, which may be more familiarly to us, were walls that separated the enclaves of the wealthy and kept in a sense their space private and away from the eyes and away from the feet of poorer people. So cities, to some extent, become more restrictive. But then cities also have that other life, and here's where a place like Manila really becomes very important, because on one hand, we can see that Manila, when the Spanish come in the 1570s, they build an area for themselves, which they call intramuros, inside the walls. And first it's their wooden walls, then they become stone walls. And it's really essentially an island that's at the isthmus where the river comes into the bay. And you have a space which would be roughly a space for about 2,000, maybe 2,500 Spaniards. And initially, others are allowed to come in. After a while, that becomes more restrictive. And so the intramuros really becomes almost like again, an enclosure and a private space. But meanwhile, what really gives Manila its life is not necessarily the 2,000 Spanish inside the Intramuros, but the 20,000 Chinese outside, or the 7,000 Japanese, and the many, many more thousands of Filipinos who are living in the various settlements across the bay. So this is again where the whole definition of insider and outsider suddenly gets turned upside down. Who is the insider and who is the outsider in a place like Manila? These are the kind of questions that I try to raise. And in some cases, they're questions that aren't really meant to be answered directly, but they're more questions that are meant to pose paradoxes or contradictions. And I think that it's, particularly in early modern society, that it's in the paradoxes and contradictions that we get a better sense of what these societies were actually like.
Well, and I think it also becomes even more apparent if we layer some of the other senses on top of this, which I'd love to now move towards, because you can physically restrict where people can move in or out of in terms of, okay, well, that's a brick wall. You can't walk through that, so you can't go over there. But that doesn't stop sounds from going over the walls. And so in some senses, you know, that's not something that could be restricted then. And to me, that very much kind of complicates in interesting ways this idea of restriction or exclusion. Can we add that idea of the early modern urban soundscape to the picture you're painting for us? What were some of the key components of this aspect?
Absolutely. And one of the things, actually, the research question that first got me involved in all of this was precisely a question about sound. And it was a question really that you could sum up most quickly by asking, how far from convents did prostitutes have to be when they did their work as sex workers? And to unpack that further, what you had in Florence in the 16th century was a gradual shift in how prostitution itself was being governed and was being legislated or registered, or regulated, sorry. And it had moved from prostitutes being forced to wear sex workers, sorry, being forced to wear physical signs, say yellow or red, or even wear a bell to indicate that they were there, and moved instead towards a sort of licensing system, whereby there were then 18 streets within the city, and prostitutes had to determine where they were going to be, and then buy a license for the street and live and work on that street. And again, these are rules which are not necessarily followed exactly. But what the government was trying to do at that point was keep sex workers away from the precincts, the areas of convents. And part of the reason for this was because the young women who had been entered into convents, we're talking about the late 16th century, would in many cases never see the outside again. And so what the concern was around sex work was not necessarily the sex workers themselves, but all the other very active sounds of life in the city that were gathered around sex work districts. So singing, taverns, fighting. And on the one hand, the civic authorities thought that this was, say, you could say, disruptive to the spiritual life, the prayer life of nuns. And this is, of course, this is the rationale they use. My sense is that beyond that concern about prayer life is that the magistrates making these rules were the very fathers who had forced their daughters into those convents because they didn't want to pay a dowry to allow that daughter to marry. And I think that in some cases, they were concerned with the fact that with really as much as anything, the mental health, not just the spiritual health, but the mental health of daughters who realized that while they were living in a city like Florence, they would never again walk its streets. And so to have them hear the sounds of people who had much more freedom would be, I think, soul destroying. Now, again, that's my interpretation on it. That's how I read, to some extent, between the lines of the regulations and how I put those regulations in conjunction or in comparison with the statistics on people entering into convents. So the historian has to bring together things that are sometimes not mentioned directly in documents, but has to use their imagination in order to determine, okay, what might this experience have been? And then when you start to do that, you, again, walk in the city and move through the city differently and start to experience things differently. The other thing, and one thing that's been the focus of work recently by some historians, including Neil Atkinson, an art historian at the University of Chicago, is bells and the importance of bells in regulating the life of cities. So there were whole series of bells, larger, smaller, often with names, very particularly defined, some of them in city buildings, some of them in church buildings. And the ringing of particular bells at particular times would be what signaled to the entire city that, say, a market was opening, the courts were opening, certain kinds of businesses could open or had to close. So you had, through the bells, really a language of communication that city authorities, both of civic, secular, and religious, had with their populations. And you would ask yourself, like, how could you possibly hear these bells? I had a wonderful experience just a few weeks ago in Florence, where I was walking down a pedestrian street, larger pedestrian street, and I was listening to this cascade of bells, which are still used, and listening to them very clearly, although I was pretty far from all of them. And yet I could hear the bells. And then a delivery truck came by, and the bells were completely overwhelmed by the sound of the delivery truck. We don't hear many parts of the city that early moderns would have heard, because we have this kind of low-level, constant buzz of background noise, of traffic, of machinery, of airplanes. You remove all that, and suddenly you hear much more about, you hear voices, you hear people sing, you hear bells, you hear, as early moderns would have, trumpets. Governments at that time, when they had announcements to make, they would make them with the accompaniment of trumpets and bells, or drums, and then a town crier. The town crier was a real thing. And these would have, for instance, in a city like Florence, there were set corners where the town criers would go and would then say, sing, yell, pronounce what they had to give. So early moderns would have an experience, a sonic experience of the city that was far richer than what we have now, because we hear cars going by. We don't hear bells in the distance, and the one really does cancel out the other.
Okay, but before we get too excited about how much nicer this all seemed, we need to talk about the smells, okay? Because it's very clear from your book that not just city smell, but like specifically European cities smell, Europeans smell. Why?
Europeans smelled because in many cases they just didn't take bathing that terribly seriously. And it's not that they were, we have some accounts where we can see that they found it very, they found it dangerous. They found it disgusting in some cases. And this is something that really emerges more in the early modern period. What we find, and really in a sense quite amusingly, is that in the Middle Ages, there was a much more of an emphasis on bathing. There were public baths, and baths were quite common in European cities right through to the end of the Renaissance. Things do begin to shift by the late 15th and into the 16th century, and some people have brought together a convergence of factors there, that bathing or baths were places where that people associated with other kinds of entertainment, including sexual activity. So baths were often associated with sex work. And so as you get, two things coming together, the expansion of syphilis, the arrival and the spread of syphilis in the end of the 15th century, and then new moral regimes in the 16th century, those two together kind of put an end to baths for public baths in many early modern cities. There is that. I suspect that there's probably other factors involved as well. What I think as much as anything, what we find is that Europeans didn't necessarily smell themselves at a certain point because they were used to their smells. Their diet, heavy and neat, certainly in the north. Their clothing that they often wore for very long times without washing, because they would wash linens, they would wear linens and wear linens close to their skin, but then the outer clothing would not necessarily be washed. It was thought, you know, it would destroy the fabric, as it often did. So they got used to a richer olfactory range, which struck others, indigenous peoples in North America, people in China, people in Africa. They couldn't understand why Europeans smelled so bad. And it really was, I think, a matter of these different kind of customs that developed over time. Europeans didn't develop as sophisticated systems then as for public sanitation as well. In many cases, their sanitation systems were far behind what you find in contemporary China, Japan, Central America. They do gradually come to that point, but one thing I describe in the book, and this really came from that exhibition in Amsterdam that I talked about. The exhibition in Amsterdam that talked about the canals and the smells of Amsterdam really focused a lot on the smell of the canals and the fact that a number of these canals, which were meant to channel river water and seawater and wash themselves out the way the canals of Venice did, they worked in some areas of the city. They didn't work in other areas of the city. And so in some parts of the city, the dominant smell would be essentially human feces. The canals were open sewers. And so you can imagine what that means, particularly when you get into the summer. And you do find some references to this in European accounts, but what's often odd is how little they refer to it. Other cities where the human waste was thrown out and into the center of the street to be washed away by rain. Again, this is the kind of thing that if it happened now, we would notice it and we would smell it. There seems to be a case here where Europeans had just, in a sense, become used to it. The classic saying at that time was that if you were traveling, you would smell a city before you ever saw it on the horizon. This was how powerful the kind of collection of both, say, human waste was, but then also rotting food, rotting animal carcasses, a whole range of smells that were simply part taken as given, and in the urban sensorium in particular.
That's a very intense picture that you've created, or sensorium, I suppose. But I did ask the question, so fair enough, that's on me. As you mentioned earlier on, a lot of what you're doing in the book is kind of combining different senses and using that as a lens into exploring what this was like. I'd like to ask about one of them in particular, because I think it's a really interesting combination of senses, and you found some really interesting things when looking through this lens. Can you walk us through some of the ways in which time could be tasted in early modern cities?
Sure. I think the way that really above all, when we're talking about time, we're talking about societies that have ritual calendars, so religious rituals, which would really shape the experience of the week and shape the experience of the year. And then that probably in the first instance, but then also festive calendars and to some extent religious calendars as well. So your experience of the year would be divided up into a whole range of days of the month, days of the week, where different experiences would be on display, or different experiences would be emphasized, and they could be either experiences of eating a lot, enjoying a lot, tasting a lot, or it could be quite the opposite, that there would be whole periods of time. I mean, in classic case is the Catholic period of Lent, the 40 days leading from Carnival up into Easter in the springtime, a day when you were supposed to eat less and eat a much narrower range of things. And so, but when we find this in Judaism, we find this in Islam, every religious tradition had a ritual calendar that alternated days of feasting and days of fasting. And so if you take it from the point of view, certainly of anybody, but let's say take it from the point of view of a child, before that child has any idea of what the doctrines of their religion are, or that what the practice of faith in the family is, before they know anything intellectually, they will experience it by taste. A child will experience the religious practices of the family and the calendar of the family by what that child is eating or not eating in different times of year. And I try again to then, imagine from that experience, move outward to, layer on different calendars. So the religious calendar is probably the most important because it has the broadest range of restrictions and also the broadest range of celebrations. Every religion mandated celebration as much as it mandated, restriction. But then you go beyond that and into particular cities when certain foods were in season. So the physical seasons, or rather the climactic seasons, would bring foods in or out at certain times. Then when you get to colonial cities, places like Manila or Boston, this would be accentuated as well with the arrival, say, of ships, that there's a very narrow window when a whole range of fresh vegetables are suddenly coming in from China. But it's a narrow range of a few months in the year when the ships can travel. And so an enormous population outside of Manila, or just in the area of Manila, that wants these things, but can only have it a few times in the year. Every city is like this. Every city has this kind of alternation that's made then, like I say, on the seasons of the year, the religious calendars, the ritual calendars, and then add on to that periods when there might simply be famine or drought, when nobody's eating, and food starts to travel in that time period. But it's still fairly early on, and many cities were dependent on what could be grown in a relatively narrow area or area close to the city itself. The end of the 16th century sees more shipment of food, things like grains, from the Baltic area into places like Italy. And it's really unusual, and that's really then to mitigate the effects of famine in Italy itself. So up until that time, you're dependent on what grows around the city, what lives, what doesn't live, the relative wealth of, say, vegetables in a place like Italy, and the relative paucity of those in a place like Amsterdam. So this is where the calendar and the seasons and the rituals would really give you a sense that the year is not just a matter of days of the week, but the year is actually experienced at the table and experienced with whole different tastes at different times of year.
That's such a fascinating combination of things that really gives us a sense of kind of what everyday life was like and how these things came together. And it's clearly so sort of embedded, so ritualized, such a kind of key part of what people would experience really all the time, as you said, even kind of before they can walk and talk. Was this sort of embeddedness a reason that Europeans were reluctant to take up foods when new foods became available through this interconnectedness, or were there other reasons?
There's a whole range of reasons. And I think, yes, part of it is that precisely that interconnectedness. And with that interconnectedness, what they had was a system that made sense to them. And it was a system of foods that was both seasonal and taste-related, but that also had elements that we might not consider at this point. And the main element was class, that there were certain certain foods that were accessible to certain classes and were healthy for certain classes, but could be actually physically unhealthy for other classes. So again, we think of ourselves as all being fundamentally the same. We have a, whatever our skin, whatever our age, whatever our origins, the physical working of our body is roughly the same. Early moderns didn't think that way. They thought that there were the body of a or the internal organs, the composition of a woman and that of a man could be quite different. The composition of an upper class person from a lower class person could be quite different. And so what they needed would be quite different, not just what they preferred or tasted, but actually what they needed to make them run. And this goes back to an ancient classical view that was called the humors, a kind of a balance of things like a blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile, that then in each person would be slightly different, but then there would be categories of difference, which would then again be based around gender, class, national origin, the rest. So their sense of what made food healthy or unhealthy was highly developed, and it was highly developed by, say, the end of the 15th century, 14th, 15th century. You suddenly introduce things into that, foods, which are completely outside of that system. They had never seen a potato. They hadn't seen a red pepper. They hadn't seen corn. How does this fit? Is this at all healthy? Probably not. And a classic case, something like the potato, Europeans of an upper class at that time thought that food that grew under the ground was really for lower class people. So upper class people should eat the part of the plant that's above the ground, and lower class people could eat the roots. But if you eat the upper class or upper part of a potato plant, you're going to get very sick. It takes a while for people in Europe in particular to accustom themselves and to try different foods and to work them into their diets. And they work them in very different kinds of ways then as well. So again, a classic way that something like corn gets worked into, say, the Italian diet, is that things were often dried and ground into a flour and then baked into a kind of a bread. So you find Italians using ground corn as polenta before they will ever use corn, say, as corn on the cob, which even in many parts of Europe for well into the 20th century is seen as pig food, not human food. So different kinds of traditions, different kind of barriers get in the way, and it'll take a long time. It takes potatoes an awful long time to get accepted, coffee less so, chocolate less so, peppers less so, some of these then are fed to animals. Some of them are brought with people, but then some of them actually do various other jumps. And this is the other thing that when we think of global movements in the early modern period, we should never think of Europe as just the center where everything is moving into Europe. But actually, potatoes, apples, they become enormous crops in India. You find different kinds of pigs being moved. Pigs that are bred in China ending up after kind of a succession of moves, ending up in England. There's a lot of global transfer of foods. Some of it. Voluntary, some of it forced. The Dutch literally steal coffee plants from Yemen and try to grow it in the Netherlands, but that ain't going to work. So they finally find a better home for coffee in Java, which they have taken over. And this is the kind of thing that I also try to describe, that in some of these global movements of foods, you find that they are being grown, they start to be grown in on a plantation scale in areas that the Europeans have colonized or claimed and colonized. And then in many cases that then require, and I would put that in heavy air quotes, but demand slave labor. So that the coming together of food, plantations, colonialism, and enslavement, it all really comes together and feeds into each other. And these then are the things that are the new foods that then start coming in commercial quantities into Europe. And that's where the companies that are responsible for that start to also take a larger role in shaping tastes. And a company like the East India Company, really, it's in the East India Company's interest to make sure that English people start drinking more tea. In the Dutch East India Company, they're really concerned about coffee. So these companies want to have markets in Europe, and so they start to develop that side of marketing, which is then, you know, moving us beyond the early days of what was called the Columbian Exchange, the exchange of foods and animals, and moves it into a commercialized exchange.
One other aspect of these many ways in which you've so helpfully described food as completely changing is the revolutionary impact of the fork. Why are forks so revolutionary?
Because they keep your fingers out of the food. The fork comes in really, it was used in Byzantium. But it was seen to some extent as a bit of an affected kind of thing. Certainly when you start to see it coming into places like Italy more in the 15th century, it's still seen as an upper class thing, a bit of an affectation, but it does gradually spread. And it gradually spreads then to, from the 15th century into the 16th and 17th century, it then will start to spread into places like France, England, the Netherlands. And the key thing is that before that time, much of the experience of eating was done not just at a communal table, but with communal bowls and communal plates, where people would have, people would literally eat out of the same pot, using their own spoons. They would drink out of the same glass, or you would drink out of the same glass as the person next to you, and just hope that person didn't leave breadcrumbs in the food. You would use your fingers. You would have a much more immediate physical contact with your food, but also to some extent with the food of your neighbors. And this is the kind of thing that, maybe it's what we think of when we go to a mall food court now, but in the early modern period, that comes to be seen as a bit uncouth. And that's really a huge revolution in the idea of what food is and what eating is, what the ritual of eating is. Because once you start to introduce a fork, you really individualize the diner's experience. So the diner now isn't taking necessarily out of a common pot with a spoon, but is possibly moving food onto his or her plate, and then eating at that plate, and it's as much as anything, it's also then a physical distance from the tactile side of food. And if you think how much people ate with their hands and used bread in order to pick up food or make food something that you could put in your hands, a lot of the food that they would eat would be soups. It would be fairly messy. So the key thing that you needed was a napkin. And somebody like the great 16th century humanist Montaigne, he says, I really can't get used to eating with a fork, but I could not possibly eat without a napkin. Because the napkin was that kept your fingers clean and kept you eating through the meal. So what you find with the fork is that it's like the thin edge of the wedge. Once you start individualizing the diner's experience, then a whole range of other individual elements come into it. The individual place setting, the individual plate, the individual cup, the individual bowl, the individual teacup. And you think then here again, the kind of corporations, the companies that I was talking about coming into play as well, that what you find by the late 17th and particularly in the 18th century, is there are whole industries. And I think England is where you see them refined to the greatest level. Industries that are devoted to to creating cutlery, extensive sets of cutlery and extensive services of multiple plates and bowls and cups that were for the individual diners. And this is the kind of thing that that really revolutionizes eating, and then as much as anything separates us from the physicality of our food and separates us from physical contact with our food.
And in many ways brings us kind of right back into what is still very familiar today. So I think that's probably a good place to end our exploration of the early modern sensorium, going right back to the beginning and then bringing us up to something much more recognizable, leaving me with only my final question, if you don't mind, Nick.
Sure.
What might you be working on now that this book is done?
So what I'm working on now is ambivalence. And so I've got a project called Ambivalent Neighbors, and it really comes down to this. How do you live next to people you'd really rather not live next to? And so this is, again, going back to space and sense in the early modern period. And what I think of in this case is, again, it often comes down to religious distinctions, class distinctions, social distinctions. So how do Christians and Jews live next to each other? How do Muslims live next to Christians or Jews? There are a few places in Europe where that does happen. And sometimes, like I said, there's walls, but sometimes there's not walls, at least not physical walls. But then when we look closer, we see there are, maybe walls made out of sound, maybe walls made out of sense. There are boundaries that are sensory boundaries and not physical ones. That's the kind of thing I'm looking at now. So again, back into the city and back into people living together and back into what it's like to sense that space.
So very much building off of this sort of work. How fascinating. Thank you for the sneak preview. And of course, best of luck with that project. And while you're working on it, of course, listeners can read the book we've been talking about, titled Senses of Space in the Early Modern World, published by Cambridge University Press. Nick, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, thanks, Miranda, for inviting me and for giving me this opportunity to share some things out of the book. I really appreciate it.